basis of our salvation. Now, one of the questions I have involves, is it possible that today, in view of what you've said and what you've taught us about what is the basis of our salvation, relying upon Christ and not on our own works. In the Old Testament, God made a requirement about the brazen snake, that they look upon it to live. Later on, they began to worship the snake. My question is it possible that we could worship our form of worship? Would that be a possibility?
Well, I believe we can take something, take the New Testament law with the wrong attitude and end up lost. And I think if we have any other attitude toward the law, then it's just simply conditions we've got to meet. We got the wrong attitude, we're causing it lost. Does that answer
you? Yeah, in other words, I was getting at there's no room for pride when it comes to our worship, the form of our worship. It's all humility.
To me, the easiest way to understand that question was to explain the difference between the obedience of faith that Paul was set to bring about and the obedience because of law. The obedience is either because of law or because of faith, and that's the difference of the new covenant, is it brings about the obedience of faith. Because of faith, because we believe, therefore we speak. If we can understand the motivation, then we have the right attitude, see. I mean, that helps me understand it. There's two kinds of obedience, just like there's two kinds of righteousness.
Well, there's always been a work of faith. There always has been. And even under the Mosaic Covenant, when they obeyed with a humble submission, it was just a work of faith. If they had an attitude of keeping it in such a way that they felt like they deserved to be saved, it was a work of law, and it caused them to be lost.
Yes, George, appreciate very much what you had to say. Some things I hadn't thought of that I'd like to talk about. You know, you refer to it as the Old Testament, the Bible does, the Old Covenant. We're under a new covenant today. You know, the Old Covenant made requirements upon people and they presented the grace of God. We understand today the requirements on us and the grace of God is extended unto us. And what basis we have, or some have, by saying that God's covenant, the requirements concerning the covenant are different, even though the covenant has changed. The covenant, basic ideas of covenants remain the same. Also, in accordance with that, under the old covenant, you know, faith was required, as you said, Hebrews chapter 11, that's what that teaches there. The latter part of that chapter deals with people under the old covenant. Also, Jesus said, the law and the prophets hang upon loving God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength, loving your neighbor as yourself. Those deal with attitudes, not just, and that's what the law is. And I'd like for you to comment on Acts chapter 15, verse 10, where Peter said, now this was referring to the Judaizing teachers and things which were that. It says, now, therefore, why tempt ye God to put a yoke upon the neck of the disciples, which neither our fathers nor we were able to bear?
Okay, in Matthew 23, I'm in chapter 24 here. I can't seem to locate the verse, but you'll recognize it when I refer to it. Jesus said, you bind heavy burdens on the people that are unable to be born, but you yourself would not touch them with one of your fingers. Now, the Pharisees were overburdening people with their human traditions. And who was it that was trying to bring in, who were they talking about in Acts chapter 15? They were talking about Judaizers who were trying to bind the Jewish traditions on the people. They're trying to bind this overburdensome law. Their concept of the law was, it's the basis of your salvation. They were trying to bind that on the people, and they were trying to bind those Jewish traditions. And it was overburdensome. Peter, I don't believe, was discussing the law of Moses as it was actually given, but he was discussing the law as the Jews had perverted it. And as it was perverted, it was overburdensome.
Now, Jesus in Matthew chapter 11, I believe it is, he said, "Come to me, all you that are weak and heavy laden, and I'll give you rest. For my yoke is easy and my burden is light." Now, Jesus was going to remove the overburdensome requirements that the Jews had made the law into. And he's going to give them an easy yoke to bear. And also, you remember over in 1 John chapter 5, I believe, the Bible says, "This is the love of God, that we keep his commandments, and his commandments are not burdens." I don't believe God ever gave a burdensome requirement to anybody. He never asked them to do what was impossible for them to do. And I think what Acts 15 verse 10 is referring to is the overburdensome law that the Jews had converted the law of Moses into.
All right, Jim.
George, I thought it was just one super job. I don't think I've ever heard better on the overall dealing with the subject. A few comments. To me, it's brought, it's completely in harmony too with Hebrews 9 and 13 says, "For if the blood of bulls and goats and the ashes of a heifer sprinkling the unclean sanctify to the purifying of the flesh." So I think, you know, we've got to admit there was some cleansing there. But it, like you talk about, is the condition and not the basis then. Now, back to, I think there's a mixing of what Bobby asked you first when he asked you about where they worship the form of the snake then, as far as paralleling that to worshiping the form of our worship. Did they worship the form of the snake or they worship the snake? You know, I think he mixed it too. He first said, you know, they worship, then we couldn't say they worship the form of the snake, they worship the snake. Now, for us now to apply that to our worship would be we'd have to worship the form of one cup or the form of one loaf, you know, or the worship. I feel like there's mixing of apples and oranges there. We can hold to this form without worshiping the items themselves. But back to a question that Gary asked earlier, and that is, would one obedience negate the other? And that is the obedience of faith and the obedience of law. I fail to see how one of them would negate necessarily the other one. For instance, a woman might, because through obedience to the law, not cut her hair because she believes the law of Christ says not to cut it, but not have the know the why behind it or the faith behind it. I think all of us in our growth have done some things because the Bible said do it, that we didn't understand the why, and I fail to believe that that would negate my faith at all, or that that would make it of no good because I just obeyed it because it was the law and not because I did it out of faith.
No, some that may be so, but what I think we have a problem arising. It's not in the amongst our brotherhood, but you know the digressives are having a real problem right now with Reuel Shelley.
Yep.
And he's teaching that it is acceptable to be baptized just to obey God. That you don't have to know what it's really for. You don't have to know whether it is for the remission of sin, just as long as you did it to obey God. Now, there are some things that we do in religion that you can't just do it just to obey God. You have to know why you're doing it. Now, if we observe the Lord's Supper just because we want to obey God, but we don't know what it's for, we're eating and drinking damnation to ourselves. So there are some things, now may not be true with everything, but there are some things that you have to know why you're doing it in order to obey it properly.
Okay, the point would be you might eat it, but you wouldn't be observing the Lord's Supper. So you could say, well, you said we could observe the Lord's Supper and not know why we do it. We wouldn't be observing.
Well, that's just a haggle over words after that. Now, you can't eat the Lord's Supper, or you can't observe the Lord's Supper unless you know what it's for.
George, I'd like you to comment on a couple of scriptures in light of your talk. John 1:17 would be one. "For the law was given by Moses, but grace and truth came by Jesus Christ." Seems to be some sort of distinction there.
Well, okay. Okay,
I don't believe that he's showing a complete antithesis. If there's a complete contrast being made, Moses brought law, let's just assume he brought law with no grace. But Jesus brought grace and truth. Well, he says grace and truth. Now, we're going to say that Moses didn't bring any truth. Moses brought truth, and he brought grace too. But I think what John 1:17 is trying to say is Jesus is more evident. Grace and truth both are more evident under the new covenant than they were under the old covenant.
Is the opposite of that true, that the system of law was more evident under the law of Moses than the extension of grace?
I don't know.
That's what I think. I think that grace was evident under the law of Moses. I think you've established that. But I think the basis of the Mosaic system was the principle of law. I think the New Testament teaches that. I think there's law in the system of Christ, and I think the basis, though, of the system is grace and truth, and I think that's what John 1:17 is saying.
I think he's just saying that it's more evident under the New Covenant than... If we're going to say that it was all law with no grace, then we're going to have to say Moses didn't bring any truth.
No, I'm not saying that. I think there was grace under the law, but I think that the principles of the law were ascended over the extensions of grace.
What do you mean, principle of law?
Well, in comparison with the New Testament system, I believe there's a law of Christ. I think we have to obey the law of Christ, but I think God's extension of grace is greater in the New Testament system than it was under the Old Testament system. That's what I'm trying to say.
Yeah, I believe in it.
But I'd like you to comment also on Hebrews 8:7, where he said if the first had been faultless, no place would have been sought for the second. What was the fault in the law of Moses?
Well, of course, that's a whole section right there, Hebrews 8, verses 8 through 12.
Yeah.
And I think what he's saying in Hebrews 8 through 12, now I may not be able to satisfy your question, but I think to some degree the law was in the heart. The Bible says, and when I make a new covenant, it'll be in their heart and so forth. The old covenant was in the heart to at least some degree, Isaiah 51:7. And there was a certain, God said, and when I bring the new covenant, I'll be their God and they'll be my people. Well, there was a close relationship with God and the Israelites to some extent in the Old Testament. Exodus 4, 32, Exodus 6 and verse 7, and so forth. But Gordon Ferguson made this statement, and I think it's accurate. The basic idea seems to be that this type of life will be characteristic under the new covenant. Dedicated service to God will be the rule rather than the exception, as was the case under the old covenant. You know, those Jews were born under the covenant, and then they had to be taught as they grew up. And obedience to God became an exception rather than the rule. But when God makes the new covenant, they'll all know me, from the least to the greatest. And I think what he's trying to show in Hebrews 8 is that under the new covenant, the rule is going to be obedience, and disobedience is going to be the exception. I think that's the contrast he's trying to make there.
I don't want to believe. Maybe I didn't understand what you said there. I don't. What is the fault with the law? I mean, he seems to be saying there is some fault with the first covenant.
Well, I think one of the faults he's talking about is physical election as opposed to spiritual election. They were born physically under the covenant. And does that make sense?
All right. We've got a whole list of questions, so let's keep it as brief as possible. Jared?
Of course, I basically agree with you, as you know. And I've always taught, one thing I've taught from, I couldn't have it taught like you did today, but I've always taught in my lessons that no man from the very beginning to this day ever earned one of God's blessings. It's always been grace, old or new, patriarchal or any other system. It looks like in your lesson, though, there may be an inbuilt weakness. And let's see, on this sin of ignorance you mentioned in Hebrews 10. Now, it is true, if we look at the 9th chapter, he spoke of something they were doing once a year in verse 25, nor yet that he should offer himself often. as the high priest entered through the holy place every year with the blood of others. However, and he may be talking about that in these first few verses of the 10th chapter, but he's not talking about it all the way through the 10th chapter, because he goes on down through there, and he says, in verse 8, sacrifice and offering and burnt offerings for sin thou wouldest not, neither had his pleasure therein, which are offered by the law. That's getting more general now. Then in verse 10, by the which will we are sanctified through the offering of the body of Jesus Christ once for all. And every priest standeth daily ministering and offering oftentimes the same sacrifices, which can never take away sins. Now there was, the law of Moses did not have a way of forgiving sins in the ultimate sense. You explained that in your lesson, I understand. But there still was a difference between that forgiveness and our forgiveness. And it didn't all have to do, it doesn't look to me like, when you study on these verses, just with the sin of ignorance that was forgiven and was being offered for. It may be true there in the first part, but we still have these other sacrifices that were offered for sins and so on. I don't know. It just looks to me like that is a built-in weakness in your lesson. I may be wrong on that, and you may have a good explanation for what I'm trying to say.
I believe in that specific verse 3, there's a remembrance each year. I think he's talking about a yearly event, the Day of Atonement. I think as he goes on throughout the later on in the same chapter, I think all he's trying to do, basically, is just show that the animal sacrifice was not the basis of forgiveness. They were just conditions. Something that has helped me, and you know, I gave a lesson here not long ago about John the Baptist and how he baptized for the remission of sins. And a lot of people, you know, they get upset when you say John baptized for the remission of sins, but that's what Luke 3:3 says. Now, how could they be received forgiveness before Jesus died? You know, the Bible says in 1 Peter 1:20 and Revelation 13:8 that Jesus was a lamb slain from the foundation of the world. And in God's timeless realm, he's basically a timeless being. And in the eyes of God, Jesus has been a lamb slain from the very beginning of the world. And on the basis of his bloodshed, he forgave those sins of the Old Testament saints. Now, Romans 4 and verse 17, this, I may be just completely abusing this particular passage. But Romans 4:17. It says, as it is written, I have made thee a father of many nations before him whom he believed, even God, who quickeneth the dead and calleth those things which be not as though they were. Now God is able, I believe, with the sins of the Old Testament saints to call things that are not as though they were. I think he could look at the blood of Jesus, which would someday be shed. It's not yet shed, but he could look at it as though it were. And on that basis, forgive them of their sins.
Well, let me say something. I don't want to prolong this. There's what I'm saying, though, the sin of ignorance they offered repeatedly, you were saying, every year.
Oh, yeah, the Day of Atonement.
But it does say that in verse 10 that animal sacrifices could never, or verse 11, can never take away sins. So they
right.
offered them for sins, but they didn't have that complete forgiveness. Is it talking about the basis or condition? Is that even in his heart when he wrote that? He's not meeting a challenge there. He's explaining something. Now, in Galatians, he was meeting a false doctrine. Here he's just explaining something. I think there's a little difference. But I may be wrong. I think, really, Hebrews 10 is a weak argument. But I can see the Galatians.
Well, you know, those Hebrews is written to Christians trying to go back under the Mosaic system. Now, if you go back under the Mosaic system and you try to keep the system now that it's been nailed to the cross, and you expect those animal sacrifices to be forgiven you now, they never constituted the basis of forgiveness.
But was he approaching Hebrews from that angle?
Well, I believe he was.
He didn't establish problem and then meet it like it did in Galatians is what I, but anyhow, that was my, I was just wondering about that. I'm not really disagreeing with your lesson.
Let's go ahead. Bill Davis, please.
I appreciated your remarks, but you probably explained this and I just missed it. In Galatians, the third chapter, and the 10th verse, he says, "For as many as are of the works of the law are under curse, for it is written, curses everyone that continueth in all things that are written in the book of the law to do them. But that no man is justified by the law in the sight of God, it is evident, for the just shall live by faith." Now, you said that a man was justified under the law by grace, is that right?
I don't know the legal system.
But this says no man is justified by the law. Now, you're saying that is an abuse of the law?
Yeah, no one is saved by the law in and of itself, or as the basis of salvation. In other words, when he quotes Leviticus 18:5 and Deuteronomy 27:26, he's referring to the legal elements of the law divorced completely from grace. If you're going to be a legalist and you feel like you deserve salvation, to deserve salvation means you don't feel like any grace is needed. You don't feel like you need any grace, you don't need any mercy. That means you're under legal elements alone. Now Paul said, yeah, he's in that passage, I see him saying, if you're going to rely on the law, in fact, the Revised Standard Version says, and I don't know if this is an accurate translation, but here's what the Revised Standard Version says, verse 9, "So then those who are men of faith are blessed with faithful Abraham, or blessed with Abraham who had faith. For all who rely on works of law are under a curse." In other words, what Paul is saying here in Galatians 3:10 is people relying on the law as the basis of their salvation are under a curse because they're not getting any grace then.
Okay, I'll grant you that. Verse 12, could you explain that the law is not of faith?
The law in and of itself, a legal element all by itself as the basis of salvation does not have any faith or grace involved. I said faith and grace are twins. It's not a faith. It has no grace or faith involved in it because they're relying on the law as the basis of their salvation. I'm having a hard time trying to express what I feel like I understand what I'm saying, but I can't put it in words.
Well, you see over in Romans 9, verse 32, it says, verse 31 says, "But Israel, which followed after the law of righteousness, hath not obtained the law of righteousness. Wherefore, because they sought it not by faith, but as it were by the law of works." You see, there seems to be a contradiction to me.
Oh, I see what you're saying. Well, I don't feel like there's a contradiction there.
They didn't pursue, what Romans 9:32, I believe, is saying is they did not pursue the law as conditions. Just simply, I'm just doing this as condition to receive grace from God. They're using it as the basis of their salvation. Now, they don't feel like they need any grace. They feel like they deserve to be saved. And with that attitude, they miss the law of righteousness, or the New American Standard says a law of righteousness. Galatians chapter 3, verse 10, the Revised Standard says they were relying on their works. Whoever relies on their works, trust in their works, which means they feel confident. You know, I can go to Judgment Day relying on my works, and I'll guarantee I'll be saved because I've got good works. And so in both passages he's saying the law is not of faith. You're going to rely on legal elements alone to save you. There's no grace involved in that. Romans chapter 9 is saying the same thing, I feel like. I don't know if I'm coming across to you.
Well, go ahead. We're taking a little too much time. Go ahead.
If Jesus Christ had succumbed to the temptation of Satan and been made unfit as a sacrifice for our sins, would there have been a single person under the law of Moses that ever been saved?
No.
Now then, that being the case, did the people under the law of Moses receive forgiveness ever before Jesus died?
I believe I did.
That forgiveness couldn't have come in retrospect at the time that Jesus died. I want to read this passage and let you say what you've got to say about it. Now here's some Jews described in the 11th chapter of the Hebrew letter who did what they did by faith.
Where are you reading?
11th chapter of Hebrews. And I'm not going to read about Isaac and Jacob and Moses and all of them. We know that whatever they did by faith. So there's no question that they did what they did by faith, which you said is a claim of grace. Now, concluding that chapter, who through faith, verse 33, subdued kingdoms, wrought righteousness, obtained promises, stopped the mouths of lions, quenched the violence of fire, escaped the edge of the sword, out of weakness were made strong, waxed valiant in fight, turned to flight the armies of aliens. Women received their dead raised to life again, and others were tortured, not accepting deliverance, that they might obtain a better resurrection. I'll not read it all, but it says that they were stoned, they were slain, they were destitute, they were afflicted. This all because of their faith of that which they anticipated that would come. Is that right? Now, and these all, having obtained a good report through faith, received not the promise, God having provided some better thing for us, that they without us should not be made perfect. Now, could they or would they have ever, or did they ever really become perfect until Jesus died and the New Testament system was ushered in?
Well,
did the man in Mark 2:5 receive actual forgiveness before Jesus died on the cross?
I don't see where that is in context with your subject.
I'm saying if Jesus could forgive sins on earth, is a man in Mark 2:5 forgiven on the basis of Jesus' blood?
I don't know. I'll be up there just in a little while and ask me questions.
In Mark 2:5, Jesus said...
He was forgiven.
All right. I'm saying if he could be forgiven while the Son of Man was on earth, why couldn't God forgive while he was in heaven?
Well,
In other words, the same way that he was forgiven, I don't know how to answer your argument really, but I know this much, he received actual forgiveness. He's forgiven on the same basis we are, on the blood of Christ. And yet Jesus hadn't died yet. Now what if Jesus had sinned before he died on the cross for this man? Would he have actually been forgiven then? Well, he'd have been just lost as the rest of those Old Testament saints.
My point is this. There's no doubt in my mind that God had the power in heaven to forgive sins just as much as Jesus had the power on earth to forgive sins, but did God say he would do it?
Exodus 20 and verse 6.
Until Jesus died.
Well, was this man forgiven until Jesus died?
Well, let me rephrase my question. Did God ever promise to forgive the Jews of their sins until Jesus died?
Like this man, yes. Exodus 20, verse 6.
I do want to say that I appreciate what you said, and I believe in grace under the patriarchal dispensation, the Old Testament and the New Testament, and I'm not calling into question the gist or essence of what you've taught, but you've confused me on several points. Thank you.
Well, I do have a verse. Romans 8 and 3, for what the law could not do, in that it was weak through the flesh, God sending his own Son, the likeness of sinful flesh, and for sin, condemned sin's flesh, that the righteousness of the law might be fulfilled in us who walk not after the flesh, but after the Spirit. I understand that the law proposed righteousness, but explain what he means about actually being righteous.
Well, I don't feel like I'm going to be able to answer these questions to the satisfaction of everybody, but let me just kind of give this. This is the way I see it in the book of Romans. Whenever reading through the book of Romans, at least primarily, every time you read about the law not being able to do this or that, I feel like he's saying law as the basis of salvation. What the law could not do in that it was weak through the flesh, he's talking about the basis of salvation. It could not all by itself, in and of itself, it was not efficacious. But as conditions...
Well, from that standpoint, I understand the New Testament, or the New Covenant, would be exactly the same, because it still is not beneficial
yeah,
on the basis of in and of itself. So what benefit is a new covenant? Why a new?
Okay. I got a list here.
I don't know if it's going to be able to satisfy, but okay. The law had a Levitical priesthood, whereas the Christian has a high priest that never changes. The Old Testament contained priests that were sinful, that had to offer sacrifice for their own sin. We have a high priest who never committed a sin. The law was temporary. The new covenant is permanent, will last to the end of time, and the Old Testament was given by prophets, whereas the New Testament is given by Christ and so forth. They're just, I feel like there's a lot of advantages that we have that they didn't, you know. If you'd like to see my list incomplete afterwards,
but not as far as salvation.
What's that?
But no advantages as far as salvation.
Well, I believe there was, but I don't really know how to express myself completely.
Still got several on the list, but we're just not going to have time to get to all of them. So if you have a very pressing question that you think is more important than somebody else's, Ron Corder?
You call my name right after you say that, let me know. George, don't get frustrated. In terms of agreement, you know, I think we recognize there's grace on the Old Testament. I don't have any problem with that. I don't have any problem with the fact that I think an awful lot of Paul's writing was dealing with the Mosaics, the Jews' view of perversion of the law. But I do think there is an apparent weakness here that doesn't help us on the other side of what you're trying to work with. And that does. The fact is, you know, grace is not really realized until Jesus Christ dies. And in spite of all the good things, I think you have to realize that if you can't bring that forth, then you've got some other problems, and the other problems you're trying to get away from. Okay, that's just... Romans 3:25, it says to declare his righteousness for the remission of sins that are past. That word remission, I understand basically that really is a past... That word remission is a different word which means a passing over. Is that correct?
No, that is the word that means passing over. The basic idea of that word, if I understand right, is to mean to let go unpunished.
But isn't the idea here again we're dealing with the fact that it's not realized yet. And it's not realized till in Jesus Christ.
Here's a comment that was offered by Gordon Ferguson. I don't know how valid this is, but he says,
the Jews enjoyed practical forgiveness, but legal forgiveness was completed with Christ's death. This distinction is proper only from the viewpoint of man.
Okay.
In other words, in our time realm, In our time realm that we live in, it was really not completed until Christ died on the cross. But in the eyes of God, he was a lamb slain.
I can appreciate the fact that God's eternal. With God, there's only now. And, you know, sometimes that helps and sometimes it doesn't. But it doesn't help us biblically because of the fact that there is more to us than just now. We live in time. God doesn't live in time. It's like C.S. Lewis said one time. He said, with God, all there is now. If that helps you, okay. If not, forget it. And to me, that's what, you can't get into that eternal aspect of dealing with this problem, because grace realized has to be unfolded. When I say this, like I say, I'm not, you know, disagreeing with the basic thing. I have one, let me ask just two quick ones. If all was needed was Jesus' sacrifice, okay? If all was needed was Jesus' sacrifice, what does that mean about the legal side of the Old Testament for me today? You see, if all that was needed was Jesus' sacrifice, what does that mean for me today about the legal side of the Old Testament? Why is it not binding on me?
Well, why is the legal side not binding on you? Well, I just feel like that the conditions that we have required of us today have just changed. The Old Testament was basically shadows and substances.
Okay, but if you would take out everything that was the civil law, other than taking out the civil law, everything else legally would still fit me, wouldn't it? Except for the civil law. I realize there's
I'm
laws.
I'm getting your question.
Okay. Well, this one I'm interested in. In John 4, where it says spirit and truth, is that statement really antithetical in your study? Is that really dichotomous? We always made spirit and truth dichotomous and antithetical. Is it?